Well, good morning. My name is Maddie Ribble. I'm with the Massachusetts Public Health Association. We're the state affiliate of APHA, so we're very happy to have all of our friends from both Massachusetts and around the country in town to Boston. I hope you're enjoying the conference so far. I'm going to be the moderator for today's session, as well as a presenter. I'm going to do double duty. We have a terrific and very accomplished panel of speakers today, and our topic is to talk about the Massachusetts Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund. How many people in the room are actually from Massachusetts? Raise your hand. Oh, very interesting. So let's see the hands of people who are not from Massachusetts. Oh, it's a very nice split. I feel like some people raised their hands more than once there. I don't know what that means. I feel like there was more than 100% of hands that went up, right? And how many people feel like they know what the trust fund is about, generally speaking? Okay, a good number. How many people have really never heard of it, except that it maybe that it exists? And how many people feel like they could really tell us a lot about it, feel like you really know something about it? One right here. Okay, good. So hopefully this will be an interesting conversation. We're going to try to leave a lot of room for question and discussion. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to introduce our panelists up front and have them come up one by one and make their remarks. So first up is going to be Senator Harriet Chandler. Senator Chandler is a Massachusetts state senator from the city of Worcester, which is, I believe, the second largest city in New England, about an hour west of here. Senator Chandler serves as the Senate Assistant Majority Leader and is a co-chair, along with our next speaker I'm going to introduce, of the Massachusetts Prevention for Health Caucus in the legislature. She's also the co-chair of the Legislative Oral Health Caucus. And she has been in the state Senate for 14 years. Prior to that, served in the House for 6 years. Senator Chandler was very kind to come in for this session today. She does have another commitment, so she is going to be unfortunately leaving before the end of it. But we appreciate that she made the time to be here with us today. Second up is Representative Jason Lewis, who represents the towns of Stoneham and Winchester, which are north of Boston. He was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives in 2008, and along with Senator Chandler, chairs the Prevention for Health Caucus, and he also serves as the vice chair of the Public Health Committee in the legislature. I will be the third speaker, and I serve as the Director of Policy and Communications for MPHA here at our state affiliate. And our fourth and final speaker is Commissioner Cheryl Bartlett, who is the Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. She is a registered nurse and also an experienced hospital administrator who has served in numerous capacities in the department for many, many years, including recently as a director of the Bureau of Community Health and Prevention. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Chandler.
Thank you so much, Maddie. Can you all hear me? Good. Really, it's an honor to be here this morning, and it's an honor to speak to you on this very exciting subject. I'm pleased to join so many health professionals here and share with you about the work that we're doing in Massachusetts at the State House regarding health and prevention. We all know that the cost of health care is crippling the budgets of families, of small businesses, of municipalities, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. As a Massachusetts state senator who's committed to issues regarding public health, I've had the privilege of co-chairing the Massachusetts Prevention for Health Caucus with my colleague, State Representative Jason Lewis. The Prevention for Health Caucus was established in March 2011. It coincided with President Barack Obama's National Prevention Council. And I should tell you that one of the reasons for its founding was that we were getting tired of the fact that we were dealing with sick care rather than health care. And I think as health care professionals, you all understand exactly what I mean. We also wanted to be in a position of having people take charge of their own care, of being subjects rather than being objects of care. And quite frankly, in sick care, that's all you are. You're an object. You don't have a chance to really take charge. Well, we started this, and it was almost beyond our belief that we could get our arms around a subject like prevention, because everyone told us that how can you possibly do something like this? Where do you begin? And that really was the problem. But since its beginning, and we began by literally beginning, the Prevention for Health Caucus has brought preventive health strategies directly to legislators and provided them with up-to-date health information to encourage them to support legislation that promotes healthy behavior, provides access to high-quality health care, and creates a culture of healthy living among children, teenagers, adults, and seniors. The mission of the Prevention Caucus is to help create, quote, a culture of prevention, unquote, in Massachusetts, where the prevention of disease and the promotion of health based on sound scientific evidence is a top priority for policymakers and practitioners. The caucus works with legislators to advocate for adequate funding for proven prevention and public health programs. It promotes legislation that includes prevention as part of any reforms to our healthcare system and emphasizes the importance of prevention in daily routines. The Prevention for Health Caucus holds several events a year where dietitians, nutritionists, health experts, physicians, nurses, and organizers of innovative community health initiatives are invited to speak at the caucus. We've even hosted Dr. Regina Benjamin, the 18th United States Surgeon General, and Dr. Howard Cole, who was our Commissioner of Public Health and who is now the 14th Assistant Secretary for Health of United States Department of Health and Human Services. Our goal at the Prevention for Health Caucus is to promote healthy lifestyles and behaviors in order to avoid disease and illness, which can eventually curb healthcare costs in Massachusetts. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? It really sounds simple. Would that it were as simple as that. As a result of the Prevention for Health Caucus's work, a $60 million state prevention trust fund was secured for the next 4 years to provide competitive grants for innovative, evidence-based programming. We're very proud of this Prevention Trust Fund. It's the first of its kind in the nation, and Massachusetts hopes to lead by example so we as a nation can face challenges in reversing alarming trends like diabetes, tobacco usage among youth, obesity, and poor nutrition. Prevention can help us stay healthy and enjoy a higher quality of life. By keeping people healthier, an ounce of prevention today can also avoid much larger healthcare expenditures later. When we bring together business, community groups, health experts, and policymakers, we can all work together to make it easier for people to make healthier choices. The other thing that we can do, and we've already begun to do that, is to make people think prevention. Prevention isn't just something way out there. Prevention is something that we want people to think about every day, about every policy issue that is brought before them. The payoff of all of this is obviously a better quality of life for individuals and for families, and lower healthcare costs for our society. Thank you once again for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. You have a wonderful array of speakers to hear, and I am delighted to have been one of them today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Chandler. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for joining us. My name is Representative Jason Lewis, and what I will do is talk a little bit about how we were thinking about the challenge of prevention and wellness and chronic diseases in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the solution that we put forward, and then Maddie will talk about the campaign that was put together, a really phenomenal campaign, both inside our legislature and outside, to see that solution actually come to fruition. So I'm sure many of you in the room are very familiar with this picture. We know that about 7 out of 10 deaths every year among our fellow Americans are caused by chronic diseases, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, certain forms of cancer. And in Massachusetts, we spend about $60 billion a year in health care, and it's estimated that about 75% of those health care dollars are going toward treating preventable chronic diseases. So while we know that the factors that determine an individual's health and health outcomes is largely within their environment and their behaviors, we put very little of our resources into prevention and helping to create an environment where individuals can make healthier choices. So that's sort of the fundamental challenge from a public health and community health perspective that we're looking at. So now we were back in about 2010, so about 3 years ago, and thinking about how investments in prevention might fit into our overall healthcare reform efforts in Massachusetts. And in a minute, I'll just give, for those of you who are not from the state, not familiar with our healthcare reform, I'll give you a quick overview of that. But we were looking at some of the emerging research and data that was starting to build a really strong case for investing in prevention, a return on investment case that would be compelling to policymakers. And some of the research that was emerging at that time, the first one is from the RWJ Foundation, a study that they did actually in 2011, and showed that mortality rates declined by 1 to 7% for each 10% increase in local public health spending, which was especially impactful in low resource communities. The second bullet point on the slide is from an Urban Institute analysis, and then the third is from, I'm sure, a report many of you are familiar with. This was the 2008 Trust for America's Health, an excellent piece of work that they did. And that included state-level data, so that's the data for the state of Massachusetts. So this was some of the emerging evidence that we could start to draw upon in terms of the economic return from investing in wellness and prevention. So here's what I mentioned a moment ago. This is kind of an overview of the journey we've traveled in Massachusetts in terms of healthcare reform. Just very briefly, for those of you who are not familiar, in 2006 was when we enacted what's known as Chapter 58, and this was the healthcare reform that was really aimed at getting all of our residents to have affordable health insurance, as you know, was largely the model for the Federal Affordable Care Act. Legislation has been very successful. We have about around 98% of our population and virtually all of our children who do have health coverage. Coming out of that legislation, we knew that we would continue to have significant challenges in terms of improving healthcare quality, reducing disparities, and dealing with rising healthcare costs. So in 2008, legislation was passed, Chapter 305. This was largely aimed at the areas of quality and cost. And one of the things it did was set up a special commission on the healthcare payment system. That was really a blue ribbon panel that looked very carefully at payment methods in the healthcare system, both experiments in locally as well as around the country. And their recommendations were issued in 2009. That then led to, in early 2011, when our new legislative session began, We have two-year legislative sessions in Massachusetts beginning in the odd year. So 2011 was the beginning of a new session. Governor Deval Patrick then, based on the recommendations of that commission, filed the next major phase in healthcare reform for Massachusetts, known as the, largely around payment reform. And that that legislation, what the governor filed at that time, really did not address much in the area of public health or anything in terms of prevention or wellness. So that was both our opportunity as well as a significant challenge, because when that piece of legislation was put forward, it wasn't really positioned as prevention, investments in prevention were not really positioned as sort of part of this next phase of healthcare reform. So we'll talk about then how we addressed that and how we sort of seized that, both addressed the challenge and seized that opportunity. But just to finish the story from a public policy standpoint, then about a year and a half later, so the summer of 2012 was when this legislation did pass our House and Senate and was signed by the governor, and that's known as Chapter 224. And just a personal note here, I think this may end up being even more significant in terms of impact on healthcare policy in our state and around the country even than Chapter 58 was. It's a very, very comprehensive piece of legislation which deals with moving our payment system, you know, from fee-for-service over time to outcome-based, quality-based measures of healthcare. It does a lot to simplify administration, to improve primary care, there's also reforms of medical malpractice that are included in the legislation, and a range of other important reforms. The piece, obviously, we're focusing on in this session is the first of its kind Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund, which was established as part of Chapter 224. So, this was sort of some of the questions that we were facing when this, against this backdrop of healthcare reform in Massachusetts. So, how would we even begin to get community-based prevention as part of this public conversation, and then ultimately as part of the legislation? And the way we thought of approaching that was come up with a specific proposal that could be, that was based upon some evidence that we had of successful approaches, both locally and across the country, where we had data and research to help, you know, back that up, and put that forward as a standalone legislation, and with the understanding that could also be rolled into this overall next phase of healthcare reform, which, you know, we were anticipating was going to be taken up during that legislative session. I'll speak more in a minute about we thought about funding that, but we did early on decide we needed to propose a dedicated funding source, and we felt that the way to approach this was we needed a campaign both among legislators, policymakers, as well as outside, that would both build support for the general case of investing in prevention, building off this growing body of evidence, and going beyond that, as well as building support for the specific proposal that we were putting forward. So it was both advocacy around large set of goals and outcomes we thought were possible, as well as a very tangible, concrete proposal that we could get rally support behind. So that the specific proposal, which was developed with a tremendous leadership from the Massachusetts Public Health Association, and Maddie Ribble, as well as Valerie Bassett, who's actually joined us today, who's the former executive director of the MPHA, and also with other leading public health organizations and healthcare organizations in the state, really kind of came together to put together this proposal, and then worked with myself in the House and with Senator Chandler in the Senate, and also with our Department of Public Health. So the proposal was to create a trust fund, so it would have a dedicated source of funding, and this fund would make competitive grants two communities. And the key was that these would include a municipality or a group of municipalities that would come together, working with nonprofits in the area as well as with clinical providers. So these would create sort of coalitions, local or regional coalitions that would take proven strategies for preventing kind of the most prevalent, most preventable conditions and a way to take those to scale. So some of you may be familiar with the Mass in Motion program, which we've had in Massachusetts since it was 2007. And that's really given us a great lens into what sorts of interventions in communities really do make a difference. And that program has been run on a shoestring budget. I mean, little small mini grants, public money, some private money, and it's had some great successes. For example, the Shape Up Somerville program has become a national model. And they've been doing it long enough now to sort of start to see actual declines in childhood obesity and other measures that they've been tracking. So we had some emerging data around these interventions at the, you know, at the community level and what sort of impact they could have. And the whole idea was, if we could bring substantially more, an order of magnitude more resources to bear to support these community efforts, and if we could do a better job tying in clinical providers as well, then we had an opportunity to really make a difference when it comes to preventing these chronic conditions. So what we had proposed in funding was $75 million a year, and that was actually based on rule of thumb metrics from the Trust for America's Health and other studies about sort of what sort of investment would be needed given a certain population size. In terms of how to come up with that funding, there were a number of criteria that we were sort of using to guide that. First of all, that we all, for those of you familiar with state budgeting and state financing, you know, in tight times, money very typically gets diverted to other uses. So it was key that this funding source be a sustainable one that we could really count on for the entire period of this program. And that the funding be sufficient to really impact healthcare costs and population health. So not mini grants of $5,000, $10,000, even $50,000. We were thinking here really getting up into the multi-million dollar range in terms of the resources available for each grantee. Third, that there be a logical link between the funding source and the cost savings, and that would help to ensure that this would be sustainable, and also to build political support for that. Fourth, that it not be overly complicated. And lastly, that anytime you're looking for additional funding, we're still kind of coming out of the Great Recession, you know, it had to be really politically viable. These were some of the options for finding the funding source for the Wellness Trust that were explored. We already do assess our health insurers, for example, for supporting our universal childhood immunization program. So that was sort of top of the list was to consider an additional assessment, and also because that would link the source of the funding with where the benefits would go, because obviously if we can do a better job with prevention, our health insurers would see great benefits from that in their bottom line. We, unfortunately, although in many areas Massachusetts really leads the country in public health, one of the ones where we do not is with our treatment of soda and sugar-sweetened beverages. Unfortunately, we don't even have a sales tax on that, and we still continue to treat those products as nutrition and food. So we would love to, we'd really like to get that exemption removed. So that was thought about. Raising the cigarette tax, raising the tax on other tobacco products, maybe some kind of broader-based revenue increase, some other types of healthcare fees or assessments, and then a few different other areas that we looked at. So where we ended up with the proposal for the legislation was the proposing an assessment on health insurers. And as I mentioned previously, the benefit of that is it builds on the model that we already have in terms of how we fund childhood vaccines. It would tie prevention sort of structurally into the healthcare financing system, existing administrative mechanisms already set up to kind of collect that money and disperse it. As I mentioned previously, it would really align those who are paying with those who stand to benefit from the program's success. So that was sort of how we thought about both the challenge that was before us and how to build the case for a potential solution as part of an overall broader healthcare reform initiative in the state. So let me hand it off here to Maddie to talk about, now that we had this specific proposal and a context set, what was the nature of the campaign that was put together, which was truly impressive effort led by MPHA to see this to turn this dream into reality.
Thank you, Representative Lewis. I just wanted to pause for a minute and ask a couple questions of you all here, both so I can know a little bit about who's sitting in the room and maybe get people on their feet for 1 minute and sort of wake up and jostle around a little bit. How many people have been involved in some way, either in your professional hat or personally, in some sort of campaign to change policy, local level, state level, federal level, and stand up if you have been involved in a campaign like that? And maybe could a couple of people just yell out what you've been involved in? Anybody from over here? And just say what that is for people who don't know. Tobacco control proposition in California. Okay. Mental health services.
Delaware versus Bolton in the Supreme Court, the abortion case.
Okay, great.
Smoke-free workplace.
Standards for food and nutrition for fast food and sales to children.
Great. Anybody up here in the front? I see some Massachusetts friends.
various budget campaigns around public health funding.
Okay, public health funding. Yeah.
Salem, Massachusetts actually started as the first city in the state to control tobacco restrictions in restaurants. And we've moved all the way up now into the pharmacy level.
Okay. Great. Great, thank you. So we have a very experienced room, which is exciting. Just a couple more questions. How many people work for an advocacy organization? Stand up.
Paid.
How many people get paid to work in an advocacy organization? A couple of people. Okay. You can take a seat. How many people work in an academic setting, a university, something like that? Stand up. Okay, good number of people. How many people work in a clinical setting, providing clinical services or supporting clinical services? Okay. The lone person in the back. Thank you for coming. Oh, a few more people. Okay. Any other sectors I didn't mention people want to yell out that they work in?
Local government.
Local government? Say it in the back again.
Local government, state government.
Local government, state government. Any others?
Federal.
Okay, great. I wanted to do this to get a sense, because we're going to talk a little bit now about the campaign to get this passed. And, often people in audiences, people haven't really been involved in these sort of campaigns. This is the different audience, self-selected, who has been, which is exciting. So often in public health, I think we think and believe, and it's actually true, that we're doing God's work and that, our policymakers and decision makers should therefore do what we say, because we're doing God's work, we're on the side of the people, we have the data, and then we're really frustrated when it doesn't go our way. And what I think we need to continue to learn how to do better is actually run the campaigns that influence those policymakers, work together with our friends in, whether they're legislatures or other policymaking bodies, and get ourselves organized to wield that influence. And we're not always good at that. So I want to use this as a little bit of a case study of how we did that, because when we started this, it really was a pie in the sky. People didn't think we could do it. And, Val was pointed out, who was our executive director at the time we started this, most people told us that's a really good idea, but, they sort of pat us on the heads. And we had some people who were quite condescending to us about how naive we were about this, and here we are. So how did that happen? Well, one thing I want to start with is, we did have the right ideas. That's a good place to start. It's not enough. But as we, started floating this idea to people, and, maybe I'll just go back a second here. floating the idea for what the sort of bones of this proposal would be, we didn't really have anyone to tell us they thought this was a terrible idea, or they thought we shouldn't fund prevention more, or we shouldn't try to support healthier communities, or we shouldn't drive more money to the local level to expand proven efforts. But there was one sticking point that made it difficult. Does anyone have any idea what that was?
Money.
Not even just money per se, but who would supply the money. Everyone loved the idea as long as somebody else paid for it. So, you know, that's not a terrible place to start with, you know, very broad consensus that we were doing the right thing. But how are we going to pay for it became the real political challenge. And so I'm going to go back to where Rep. Lewis left off. We decided we really needed to do this on sort of two concurrent streams of advocacy. One, we needed to just create a louder drumbeat that we needed to fund community-based prevention, and that if we were going to embark upon this broad statewide discussion about reforming our payment system to control costs and improve quality, that we could not succeed at that without funding prevention. And we needed to build that drumbeat because we have like in many states, I think we have a very robust and active healthcare community here from providers and advocates and so forth, and a very loud and public discussion about healthcare access, healthcare financing, and public health isn't always quite as loud. So we felt like first and foremost, we just need to be louder in this conversation. Even with colleagues who may not agree with every part of our proposal or with how we want to finance it, we need to find a way to engage them in raising the volume of this conversation. But then we faced a question to say, do we just want to do that and then sort of hope that the legislature finds a way to make it real? Because that way we could build a bigger tent. We wouldn't have to alienate anybody. Once you get into the details, you start alienating people who don't love every detail. But we really felt like that wouldn't serve our efforts well, that we needed to put something very concrete on the table and ask people to come to the table and discuss that proposal and even perhaps disagree with it, offer an alternative proposal, and especially on the financing. So at the same time we were trying to engage every conceivable ally in raising the volume, we also needed to put, we felt, a specific financing proposal on the table. And as Representative Lewis pointed out, it was to assess health insurers. And we never approached this to start bashing the health insurers. There's, you know, people in public health are sometimes politically popular to sort of bash the health insurers, but we felt like they were a really important ally in the work we would need to do in prevention, and they had been very engaged in Massachusetts in that conversation. But we had a financing proposal we thought we could justify because we started with criteria. We thought it was the most rational and sensible and most likely to succeed, and we also thought that those health insurers could benefit financially from the success of it if we engaged them. So it was never about bashing them, but it was about trying to put something credible on the table. And we really said from day one, anybody who doesn't like this, who has a better idea, we'd love to discuss it with you. We'd love you to come to the table and talk to us about it. And let's talk about the criteria and how an alternative idea could help meet those criteria better. And I think that was a good way to start, and I know Val did a lot of this work when this started off, was getting in touch with those players right up front to say, this is not an effort to go to war with you, but we want to start a dialogue with you, and we'd love you to come to the table. And I think it sort of diffused what otherwise might have been a lot of tension at the beginning of a campaign like this. So this was a campaign kickoff we had. You can see Val there on the right. this is Senator Richard Moore there in the center with the microphone, a longtime chair of our Senate Healthcare Financing Committee. And this is a great example because he didn't really support the specific legislation we had filed. He didn't support the financing proposal. But we said, you know, Senator Moore, we've worked with you for so long. Would you come to this kickoff and talk about why prevention is so important? And he said he was happy to do that. And that was key to have someone like him who's a real elder statesman, you know, ideologically probably a pretty conservative guy, coming to help us kick this off. We also really wanted to talk about the data. So we brought up a researcher from the Urban Institute who had just months prior to this released a paper that looked at cost savings based on 5% reduction in prevalence of diabetes and hypertension. And the great thing about that paper, some people may remember, is it broke that cost savings down by state and then within each state by payer. And it was a model, obviously, but you could really see what we might be able to achieve in cost savings. And we really wanted to put that at the forefront. these are some of the supporters we built through the course of this campaign. And it was really a person-to-person campaign. We have 200 legislators here in Massachusetts between the House and the Senate. By the end of it, more than 100 of them had actively supported this. Obviously, the Prevention for Health Caucus under Rep. Lewis's leadership and Senator Chandler's. We went out to mayors and town managers and said, we really need you to support this because we know you're really concerned about municipal health care costs. In Massachusetts, we have 351 separate cities and towns. We don't have much in the way of county government. So we have very small towns managing their municipal health care costs when they're struggling. We also had the example of the Mass in Motion program, which sent money to the municipal level. Of course, municipal officials love that when they have money coming their way and see results for it. And they're very, very respected in the legislature, what those local officials think. So we wanted to really focus on building their support. Many traditional allies in the community-based public health world, and some in the healthcare world too. Now you have to remember the backdrop of this is a debate about sort of how to reform our payment system. So our clinical leaders, our health insurance companies, others in the delivery system have a lot at stake in this conversation that's going on in the background. And it was hard to get those folks to pay attention to prevention when they had so much at stake. But we were able to get some important leaders from the healthcare world on board to say this is important. And I think that made a big difference. Let me go back. We spent a lot of time inside the State House with our champions, with Representative Lewis, working with the chairs of important committees and talking this through with them. And again, from day one, I think we found everyone extremely open to the idea, and we found we didn't really have to convince people that we needed to do it. We had to convince people that we could pay for it and that it would work. So we got right past the conversation of is this important, would it be worthwhile, and people started asking us hard questions about can we pay for it, will it work, including, you know, Representative Steve Walsh, who chaired our Healthcare Financing Committee in the House. We went to the Senate side and met with the Senate President and her staff, who, by the way, if you're around tonight, we are honoring her along with Mayor Menino at our reception at 6:30, because what we heard from her and her staff from day one is we want to make public health a centerpiece of this bill. Even though most people are talking about reforming payment methodologies, she knew and her staff knew public health needed to be at the center. But they started asking hard questions. How do we pay for it? How do we make it work? But we knew that wouldn't be enough, even if you have great allies. We needed to create pressure on the outside as well. So, you know, we did everything that might be in the playbook for a campaign like this. We did press conferences. We did rallies. We tried to get it in the press. We tried to focus on the data. We held a series of mini lobby days where we said, you know, we can't throw a big rally with, you know, hundreds of people every other month, but we have to keep this front and center for legislators. So we would bring up a dozen people once a month and hit 50 legislators' offices in a morning, and it just kept it on the radar for people. The moment, I think, when many of us thought, you know, we might be onto something here, and maybe this isn't just one other campaign where we're hitting ourselves on the head, doing the right thing, but sort of falling on our faces, is we put out a call for people to sign on to a letter to the legislative leaders calling for a bill such as this one to be passed. And we had over 300 signatures on that letter in the course of a couple of months, and a really diverse set of partners, again, from municipal government, business leaders, all kinds of folks. And we thought, you know, we might really be onto something here. We might be really tapping into some support. We also engaged, well, at least what for us were unusual allies, and this is a rally and a conference from the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, which for folks in Massachusetts may know is quite a large and respected and powerful group of interfaith leaders from dozens and dozens of congregations in the Greater Boston area who took this on as a top priority, and that really sort of turned people's heads. This was a quote, I won't read it to you because it's up there, but from some of our business community, who again said, didn't ever endorse a specific proposal or specific bill, but came out pretty strongly to say we have to include this. This is just an example of some press we were able to go after. We tried to place op-eds and papers around the state. We didn't just focus on the Boston Globe. We made sure those regional papers in Springfield and Fall River and Lawrence, the elected officials and leaders in those communities saw people speaking out. We had Mayor Menino here in Boston put his name on an op-ed that did run in the Boston Globe. You can see this is Mayor Flanagan from Fall River here on the right. Those voices were really important to this. And this is just a picture of our sort of, I think whether it was our final rally. You can see this is Senator Chandler here at the microphone. And, you know, if you're from Massachusetts, you might know some of these people, but this is a really impressive group of, you know, municipal officials. These are interfaith leaders. These are clinical healthcare leaders. These are health access advocates. These are public health advocates. And you have an overflowing room full of people saying, we have to do this, and we have to do it now. The last piece I want to mention in terms of the campaign is we're able, really at the 11th hour, to work with Trust for America's Health, who many of you probably know, who was doing a series of state-by-state briefs about money we could save by investing in obesity prevention efforts. And TIFA was great because we called them up. They said, you know, we have this brief. It's ready to come out in a couple of months. But we said, we have a bill in conference committee that we really need help with. We think is not only be great for Massachusetts, but could be a national model. And they said, you know, we're going to rush the Massachusetts brief to press and work with you on the messaging of the brief so it can be helpful in your, you know, 11th hour efforts with the conference committee. And I think that really spoke spoke to their commitment to supporting local leaders. And I think it really made a difference. At the end of the day, this was 69 signatures of representatives and senators who called for the conference committee to include at least $100 million in this fund. And that's very hard to do because legislators like all of us love to get behind a concept to say, you know, we want healthier communities or we want money for local communities. It's much harder when you start talking about those details, especially a number as significant as $100 million. So the fact that by the end of this campaign, 69 legislators, again, sort of across an ideological spectrum, are signing on to the conference committee to say at least $100 million really showed how far we had come. And I'm going to skip forward a little bit in the interest of time, except to, this is the governor signing the bill, along with members of his cabinet and legislative leaders. Except to say the final, and this is going to go into Commissioner Bartlett's presentation, the final bill that was passed did adopt our recommendation to provide an assessment on health insurers, I think because it was a rational approach. And they also assessed large hospitals for a portion of a larger fund that was actually broken up into three buckets that you can see here on the bottom. And only part of that was for the Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund. So lastly, you know, just looking forward, and I think this will become a little more clear once you hear Commissioner Bartlett talk about the implementation. But because what was in the final law was a four-year fund, and you'll remember this bill that we wanted to make sure embraced public health was a cost control bill. So we had to sort of hang our hat on the ability of public health to control costs. And I think the way I read it at the end of the day is our legislative leader said to us, we believe you, we get it. Prevention is important to our efforts to contain costs. But they said, show us that it works. Show us the data. Here's $60 million. When was the last time we had $60 million appropriated or provided in Massachusetts for public health or in any state? That was very significant. But they said, show us that it works. Come back in 4 years and show us the data. And I think people here who are public health professionals will get immediately why showing return on investment and reduction in healthcare costs in 4 years is incredibly difficult. But it's sort of a hard proposition to turn down to say, here's $60 million, but show us that it works. So now we need to show that it works in order to get some sort of funding reauthorized. But it really pushes the funding closer to secondary prevention models, which can have a quicker return on investment than some of the primary prevention models we had really been thinking about at the beginning. But I think in public health, we've always worked for the long term, whether it's in tobacco or around nutrition. So my hope is that although this fund as it is right now is not everything we had envisioned 3 years ago, that we will take up the challenge of showing that it's successful so we can get some sort of funding reauthorized, get the scope broadened perhaps, and be able to focus more on primary prevention down the road to show that that's successful. But we need to show that it works first. And that's where, you know, we have all the fun as advocates, and then we turn it over to the state to say, you know, have fun making it happen. Good luck. So we are really proud to partner with Commissioner Bartlett and her team, and I'm going to turn it over to her to talk about how it's being implemented.